And I'm starting this off today, perhaps to the amusement of quite a few of you, is that after considering and discussing the matter with several chaps and with one or two teams of husband and wife, the possibility of dealing with the subject or starting it off, it appeared that it would be rather embarrassing for any parents to talk around the subject of their own children, young or not so young, and so it was left to the old bachelor to be set up as a kind of an Aunt Sally, whom you can hit and laugh at as much as you like. This explains also the fact that it was difficult to get someone to talk on the subject who knew something about it rather than somebody who's supposed to know nothing about it. This explains my use, which I'll make in a moment, of a family amongst us as an example, which I hope will not cause them or anyone else undue embarrassment. I'll keep to my manuscript and be as brief as I can, because I would like there to be a pretty full discussion afterwards. Maybe I'll manage to be provocative enough to make some of the women folk speak up. The advantage of having lived through nearly three generations is that one sees what happens to individuals and families and Christian family fellowships long term. And one may therefore have a better understanding of what is of abiding value in the establishing of Christian homes and in the rearing of families for Christ, not to say the establishment of Christian congregations. Having been asked recently to give an address on Genesis 17:1-8 to Aberdeen CU, and taking the lesson from a larger sweep of that chapter, including circumcision, which the Wiley Committee seemed to have stopped short of, I believe I gave from the scriptures then a thoroughly convincing case for the continuity of Christian life and witness from one generation to another. And I'll quote from that later on. Deuteronomy 7 and 9 says, God keeps his covenant of love to 1,000 generations. And studying that chapter recently, I counted it out, that whereas we look back 2,000 years to Christ and 4,000 years to Abraham and 10,000 years to Homer, that would look forward 25,000 years or something like that. 25,000 years of consistent family witness. And that must mean that the Christian norm is each generation succeeding the other in warm, living, true Christian witness. The Bible pattern is quite plain, although it also shows the exceptions. Esau, for example, brought up with Jacob in a divided house with an indulgent father and parent who each had their favorites. And I have watched for many years to see this biblical principle wrought out in Christian family life. I remember some years ago hearing Donald Mackay of Greenbank Church, Edinburgh, preaching in Betty Hill Church while I was on holiday, the land of his fathers, where nearly every gravestone is inscribed Mackay. And I heard him say on that occasion that he was the sixth generation of ministers in his family. And I want to say this afternoon that I think one of the best examples of what a Christian home life can do for a family, a larger family, is seen in our own Mackenzie family here. Andrew and Annie came to us from the small Isles, where he was a lay missionary, having been a joiner and then a factor of an estate before that. And as I saw how that large family existed on a shoestring in Aberdeen during their sojourn there, and seeing what that family have become, I learned more lessons from them on this than from anyone except my own dear mother, who, in a divided home, Christian-wise, manfully sought to bring six of us up to serve the Lord. There was no division in the Mackenzie home. And I want to say right away, I don't want to embarrass Andrew and Annie, or Ian and Anna either, or the other members of the family not here, but I simply ask you to look at the number of ministers here today, and they may not all be here, who can testify to the worth, who can testify to the worth in faithfulness of the children of that marriage. I can abundantly and freely acknowledge it. Ian Lane can. Crawford, the architect, and his dear wife. David Grant can, Dalry, Jean, remedial teacher. Gordon Jenkins can, Dunfermline, having had Jean in his congregation for some time. Ian McCree can. Bob McKee of Falkirk certainly can. David, a very influential teacher in that area. And although this is not specifically Christian, Glasgow Corporation can, and would tell you of the value of Andy McKenzie Jr., who is master of works, nothing less than for that vast city of Glasgow. The secret of that family, as I see it, was and is the mixture, the blending of living close to each other in the Lord, parents with children and children with their parents and children with children, not perfect any more than any other family, along with firm godly discipline and quiet authority. As I saw it, Andrew was a chum to his boys, but he never ceased to be father to them. They would tell you that. And the same with Annie, with the boys and with the girls. And they had another member of the family that I haven't mentioned who is now with the Lord. They had a handicapped lassie whose life was ruined by the Clydebank bombing. And they added to their own six at what one might regard as the most involving part of their family life together. They added to their own six one of the most difficult girls of 14 years of age that Cynthia Dixon, the psychologist in Aberdeen, ever had under her care. And they took her, officially adopted her, struggled with her for years, until she also is now a good witness for Christ in her own home in the South with a Christian husband. Now, I want to say also, in case you think I want to boast about our friends, you couldn't get a more modest, simple, homespun family than the Mackenzies. But I've always found in them, and I've often asked myself why, and I don't know that I can fully answer this, I've always found in them a reservoir of wisdom in practical matters, which, alas, eluded far more pretentious and prestigious families. And although they would all deny it, shaking their heads in disbelief, I have in my mind more often sat at their feet than at that of any other family to learn how a Christian family should live and be brought up. And if you were to ask them the secret, they would be surprised because it is all so native and natural. Yet, as I say, it eludes so many. I'm sure it stems from the authoritative grace of God, not at all unrelated to some of the things we were thinking of this morning. The authoritative grace of God wrought out in the whole of life. It was not a super pious home at all, thank God. It did not need to be. There was no need whatsoever for self-conscious piety. God was in it all. And I knew nothing more holy than sitting round the family table with them, chatting about anything and everything. And one knew that the Lord was in the midst. But one felt that there was a great hidden reservoir of strength there. Or to change the metaphor or simile, like a massive steel beam running right through the house from foundation to ceiling. There was strength there. But it was so often the iron hand and the velvet glove. Now, as a contrast to that, let me share with you a part of a letter which one of our oil boys, a geologist, an Oxford man actually, who is now in California via Aberdeen and Norway, wrote to me the other week. Bob and Helen James. It speaks for itself. They say, a lot of questions arise which you may not have the time to answer. Perhaps the issue could come up in a record letter sometime. But we do have one which we would appreciate comment on. This concerns disciplining children. We've discovered a difference of opinion between ourselves and some of our good American Christian friends as to the degree to which one should beat children for a rebellious attitude. Our friends say that if a rebellious, insubordinate attitude appears, the child should be beaten until that attitude has been replaced by a meek submission. I remember squirming when I read it. They say that this should be done even if no wrong action is being done, or if there is no disobedience. A rebellious spirit in itself justifies a beating. It must be thrashed out of them. And they quote there, someone had said that. Now, Bob and Helen say, we believe that this view is harmfully harsh, and we disagree with it for several reasons. Firstly, we are not sure how a parent can always detect a rebellious attitude with certainty. Certainly with temper tantrums one can, and that should be dealt with. But should sullenness alone be punished physically? Secondly, we feel that a rebellious or cheeky attitude will inevitably express itself sooner or later in specific disobedient actions which are punishable and which the child knows are punishable. We feel we have biblical grounds for this. God knew all along that his Old Testament people were stiff-necked and rebellious, but he never punished them for this attitude in itself. He punished them for the specific sinful action, idolatry, which was the inevitable fruit of the rebellious spirit. So we feel that our friends are being unnecessarily harsh with their children, and we fear that they may harm them in some way. God was and is strict and stern with his people, but never harsh so that they are crushed. We would love to know what you think about this. You've seen a lot of parents bringing up their children. We think we're on the right track with Richard and Francis because they give definite evidence of loving the Lord. This is the crux, isn't it? Definite evidence of loving the Lord, but we know we do many things wrong. Were it not for God's grace in remedying our defects and mistakes, we would fail completely. Now, amongst the things that I answered are these. First of all, to say that they live, and their church is in the midst of the university city of, I think the Americans call it Berkeley, do they? Berkeley. That name, of course, has lurid associations in our minds from into the 1960s, and we can understand the kind of characters that might still be around there. And I answer this. Now, as to your question about the children, your first sentence about beating them gave me a jerk. I am a firm believer in punishment. One could not deal honestly with the Bible without holding such a view. This is what is wrong with our Western world today. People try to say the New Testament is more pacific than the Old. But that simply means that punishment, in the sense of penalty, is tied to the issue of Jesus Christ and eternal hell as a result of rejection of him. Hebrews 12 is very clear on this. Hence the writer's words in Hebrews 12:25, that if they escape not who refuse him that spake on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven. However, your children in a Christian home are not at all in the situation of those whom the writer to the Hebrews is warning. Loving discipline of children brought up in the Lord should ultimately, wonder what you think of this sentence, loving discipline of children brought up in the Lord should ultimately become so refined that a gentle word or even a flick of the eyelid should be sufficient for a Christian child to know that the wealth of love lavished on it ought not to encourage it or allow it to take advantage. I stress the word ultimately there. And I go on to say, if your American friends are Christians and their children have grown up with a disobedient and rebellious spirit, it seems to me to mean that the parents may have not claimed the new birth of their children, which baptism symbolizes, and may therefore have brought them up as little sinners rather than as little saints. And that would be the core of what I'm saying. And what I've seen, that's the difference. That's our difference from the Baptists in general. They do bring them up as little sinners. Of course, we're all sinners, but we're saints too. The threshing of Israel in the Old Testament was largely the threshing of the unregenerate Israel, whereas I would not think that the naughtiness of your precious children were signs of that. Do they not already love the Lord Jesus? And they said they do. Yes, but you may say, they can be very naughty. Of course, as we ourselves in our own grown-up way can be very naughty, because the dregs or the remnants of corruption are still within us and are susceptible and vulnerable to Satan's machinations if we let him in. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that the controversy between these American families and yourselves shows a very great difference. A difference between you and them. That you are, so much so that you are practically operating on different wavelengths. Different world, almost. I think even the physical punishment of a Christian child could be held in reserve, like the strap or the cane in the schoolroom. But in the best circumstances, would seldom, if ever, be used. And indeed, the fact that it was there, and less used, and mentioned even, simply through grace, thinking of the home now, would encourage respect for authority. And it is indeed from that very place of supreme authority and command that God proffers to us his gracious covenant mercy. That's only part of the letter, and so I'm saying here to close. Now, that's a long story, but I think it is quite in keeping with what you say and seem to think. And I want to say that I fully approve of your position and hope you will be able to convince some of your friends not only that your position is right biblically, but that, blessed be God, it works. We can certainly say, from long experience now in Aberdeen, that it works. It produces the goods. The joy we have in children whom we have seen grow up from infancy, teenage to manhood and womanhood, abundantly supports what we hold and believe and practice. Now, having said that, I want to end what I have to say as to both the theory and the practice of bringing up children in the Lord and in the manse with a page from this address that I gave to the Aberdeen CU several weeks ago. They gave me, as I said earlier, Genesis 17:1-8 as the first in a series of 5 addresses on God in history, the first being on Abraham. It was on God's covenant with Abraham, but it stopped short of God's call for Abraham's response and circumcision. But I soon put that right. Start from here then. After Genesis 12:1-3, God continued to speak and to appear. Not only to speak, but to appear, which is very important, to Abraham, in a series of events which are so dramatic and numerous that to deal adequately with one of them in one address would be to neglect all the others. But if you take Genesis chapters 15, 16, 17, containing your passage, I'm saying, 18, 21, and 22, you will see that following the first promise of God to Abraham in Genesis 12:1-3, and the fact of Abraham and Sarah's childlessness, these chapters are practically all about progeny and generations to come. That's the subject. Or at least about the first generation to come. Which, and this was the problem, wasn't coming. That was Abraham and Sarah's problem. And didn't come until these two were impossibly old. The promise was all to do with generations to come. By natural generation. But not natural generation by itself, or automatically. Isaac and Jacob were just as fallen and naturally sinful as Abraham himself. And the importance of circumcision is that although the covenant was to the progeny of Abraham, it was not to them in their natural state, but by the symbolic rite of circumcision. If we all know what circumcision signified. If we don't, then we look up in particular Deuteronomy 30:6 and see that it represents the circumcision of the heart. You will see that. We were dealing with this last night in church. We're doing Deuteronomy just now, and we're looking at chapter 10 last night, and you have it there. It's the first occurrence of the phrase, circumcise your hearts. And then it occurs, in a sense, more significantly in Deuteronomy 30:6. You find it much later in Jeremiah 4:4. The latter two references are in the active voice, the first in the passive voice. But whether the rite is viewed as performed by men as a rite, or as wrought by God as a spiritual work of electing and saving grace, it is first an acknowledgement of the uncleanness of fallen human nature. And indeed, as an outward rite, it was performed within 8 days of Isaac's birth to indicate right away two things. First, that God's purposes were intended to be fulfilled by successive generations of his chosen people. But the offspring were never acceptable to God in their natural state as sinners, born in sin and shapen in iniquity. But having been made the objects of grace in salvation through the deliberate, purposive, believing act of faith of their parents, marking them, if you like, with the sign of the cross. Thus they were indicating that they were promising to bring them up within the covenant as God's children, nothing else, nothing less. Abraham and Sarah brought up Isaac as God's child within the covenant. That is to say, they sought not his conversion, which they assumed, not his conversion as a growing boy, but his consecration. That was why it was so fearfully costly for Abraham to take his stripling, youthful son to essay, to attempt at God's incomprehensible command to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. You see, the promise had to be fulfilled through Abraham's miracle son of his old age. Ishmael the Arab was totally unacceptable. There was no other. God continually speaks of Isaac long after Ishmael is born as your only son. Your only son. And of course, Galatians brings this out wonderfully well. But not naturally. Not naturally. The child had to be signed in faith by the sign of the cross, as it were, the Holy Spirit in action, to show how natural descent and the act of faith in response to God's gracious covenant in Genesis 17, natural descent and the act of faith work together to fulfill God's purpose. This is the greatness of Abraham's faith. Now, would it be wise to begin on the doctrinal side or the practical? One other thing that I meant to say and put into that I didn't. By claiming, and I love this word, on the basis of a covenant, but there's nothing automatic about it, by claiming our children for the Lord, certainly does not mean that they, if one has several children, that they will all necessarily grow up and into the Lord with the same ease. One may go right on, like I know quite a number of children now getting into their teens and well on to their teens, of whom their parents will say there never was any major problem at all with them. And in those circumstances, of course, I think that is partly due, apart from the gracious attitude of the home, the time the parents, father and mother, take to explain and answer questions and take time with their children, which modern parents don't seem to have very much time for. My mind's cut out. Give me.
Sorry, I'm distracted.
It's all right.
Time. Parents not having time for their children.
Yes, my mind sometimes cuts out. It'll come back. Yes. One child may just grow right up in the Lord and be no problem. Another child or other children may be difficult from the beginning. And I believe it's possible for such children to grow up and rebel and go into the wilderness, alas, and even parents dying praying. These all died in faith. That's a tremendous word in Hebrews 11, isn't it? 13 and 39. These all died in faith. It's a tremendous thing to die in faith, isn't it? They may die in faith and not see on earth the inevitable conversion of their children. So I don't want you to think that one is setting some rigid standard for all children. Far, far from it. One couldn't have experience of life and family life and hold such a rigid view. So I wanted to say that. All right.
Did you really mean inevitable?
Yes. If you believe that you have it, you have it. Jesus said that. I didn't say it. If you believe you have it, you have it. And if you don't link that with Genesis 17 and the covenant, I don't know what you do.
Come on now. What's your question? Start the discussion.
What on earth is the matter with this?
Embarrassing.
Mr. Still, you asked whether we should begin doctrinally or practically. Could we perhaps begin practically? Could you say a word or two about family worship, or ask someone that you perhaps might know who would care to speak in that, and family worship, and how the best way to do it, and with little children?
In these modern days, there's much where there is anything like family worship. It can be of various sorts. Recently of and I suppose this applies perhaps to many young ministers and their wives, that there isn't so much of that until the children come, although there should be, but surely it is very much easier. Maybe I don't know why it should be, I can't understand this, but human nature, it would be very much easier to I think, to begin with the little children. I think of Graham Houston's not here today, but I remember spending a weekend with them in Helmsdale, and their little girlie at that time would have been about two, I think. And I was absolutely astonished at the breakfast table, to each meal, especially breakfast, by the little picture book she had, how she was able to enter into intercessions. And
She reminded Daddy he'd to pray for Mr. Till, you see. And she knew Elijah. She knew Elijah and could stumble over his name. And the general impression was that little girl of two had an amazing understanding. Of course, it was limited. Amazing understanding, and she was entering into the whole thing. So I suppose the word from that is to start very, very early. I wonder why Christian people are embarrassed at family worship. I suppose it's because we don't start that way. People don't start that way. Those who have been brought up with it from the beginning, it's perfectly natural. We have a Highland family with us who'll be going from us shortly with four children, and they were brought up in the island of Harris with family worship morning and evening, and they have it still. One night they came in travelling from the south at 11:30, and one of the boys said, "There won't be family worship tonight." "Oh yes, we'll have time for a little." And it's just part of the life. One thing that Duncan Martin said to me about that, we were chatting about this in earlier days when we were unfolding this doctrine of baptism, which has had such fruitful results amongst us. He said, "You see, Mr. Still, you won't misunderstand me if I say that in one sense, given the church and given the word in the church, and all the upbuilding that comes from that, you'll understand that the Christian life in the home is very much more important than Christian life in the church. Because you see, you go to church all dressed up specially, or some people do, once or twice on a Sunday, whereas family worship at home, you have it every day of the week in the context of people running out to school and the telephone bell ringing and all sorts of things." And he says the kids begin to see that the whole thing is woven into the warp and woof of everyday life. And I think that's a very, very important point when one sees the fruitfulness in the life of that particular family. Am I waffling, Andy?
No, that's helpful.
Can I come back on a practical point? I think when children start to grow up, it's very embarrassing. I was brought up on family worship morning and evening till I was about 18. And from the age of 13, I didn't ask my pals back for tea because I was so embarrassed about it. And obviously, I think it depends on the way parents conduct that and how sensitive they are. But certainly, you know, for me, it was a real turn-off, basically.
That would be one of my central points, Francis, that it's the way you do it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Grace, not law. Or the law.
I think it's easy with wee kids, but once children get to the teenage stage, I think it needs rethinking.
Yeah.
Mr. Still, Esau was also marked. Did Abraham not equally claim him? And are you saying, therefore, that we've not to expect all our children to come?
I was dealing with that last night. Because I said to the congregation, now you will... But I quoted the sentence from Hebrews 11, "By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau." And I said, now you'll instantly say, "Ah, Esau, we've got." And my argument, and I was thinking more of that early this morning. There's a good deal to be said, and I hinted at that family. It was a divided house. God had revealed to Rebekah. Now, one notices the terms that the younger, the elder will serve the younger. Is that how it would? I think it is. You see, now God didn't say that Jacob would be the one and Esau would be damned. Oh, I have no doubt at all from Scripture that Esau's in hell. No doubt about that at all. But it seems to me that what faith Isaac, in particular, may have had for Esau was exceedingly faulty, whether it was real faith or not, because, you see, he was his favorite and he was attracted to him. He was attracted to him naturally. He liked his way of life. He was very fond of wild game and the hunt and all this kind of thing. And the division in the household, I could well believe. I think if there's anything in the whole thing, it must inevitably be the case that they did not have faith for Esau. Because if they had faith for Esau, he would have been saved. Is that not the principle of Scripture? It's by faith. Go on now. Go on now.
Was Esau circumcised?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, it could be just as baptism often is, a mere outward rite.
But that means, Mr. Still, that it's no longer inevitable that a child of a Christian parent should be saved. If what you're saying is correct, it's only inevitable if the parents have faith in the proper way for the child.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's not inevitable, it depends on the parents.
But I was using the word inevitably in that context, absolutely.
So it's possible for the child of a Christian parent to go to hell?
Of course, of course. Of course, and that has happened throughout history, one is sure, over and over and over. No question about that.
It's just that I didn't understand that before you were saying.
Mr. Still, may I say, as well as life and the man, as well as family worship, it's very important that husband and wife should pray together. Because this is where the understanding is sinful,
yes,
and it
yes,
comes
yes,
to them
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
A lot of husband and wife don't pray together because I've often spoken
about it. I quite agree with that. I wasn't excusing that. I was simply saying it's a fact that it very often starts with the family.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Steele, could you say something in expanding your answer in the light of election? This is my problem. I know one can't reconcile or is one meant to God's sovereignty and man's responsibility, but you seem to say that responsibility lies completely with the parents, in that one is saved and the other isn't.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that in view of raising the question about Esau. I think one's responsibility, this is how I like to put it as simply as I can, I think one's responsibility is to seek with all earnestness, as perhaps the most important thing in one's life, perhaps even more important than one's ministry, to seek for that quality of faith, which is not mere hoping or pleading faith, but claiming faith that says, we have. That's all I'm saying. It doesn't follow. It may be, it could be, I suppose it has been, that some of the godliest families have not been able to have that distinctive quality of faith in respect of one of their children. But I think the responsibility is to seek it. And I think very often we don't realize how important it is to go beyond a mere pleading or hoping, whatever word you use, faith. You see. To a faith that says, now. And I must say that I have known increasingly parents who in when their children have been very small, before there's been much sign of a response, and I'm talking with this little girlie of two, have been sure. That's not to say there were no difficulties in teenage years, 12 to 15 and all that. We know all about that. A lot about it. But sure. And one of the things that I must say is this. I have spent long time with broken-hearted parents who have felt that their children were going the wrong way. I recall one dear widowed mother saying to me about her daughter about the age of 13. She stamped her feet on the floor. She said, "I'm not a Christian and I'm not going to be a Christian." "Well, Mr. Still says, what do you do about that?" I says, "Just tell her that she can't do anything about it. It is beyond her." And that was some years ago. And she's a bright Christian today. And it's this determination of the parents that comes from God. This is God's gift of grace. Faith that holds on and believes. This is not the essence of the Bible. Hebrews 11. Holding on in faith. It's that. That does it. We are saved by faith. Our children are saved by faith. And in a sense, are saved by our faith first and then their own. Does that sound queer? It certainly works.
Does that mean that God didn't give Isaac that faith for Esau? Or was it?
Oh, I think it must mean that. I think it must mean that. I think it must mean that. What else in the world when you read what's said about Esau in Hebrews 12, isn't it? I think it must mean that. And it's very, very frightening, but we've got to face up to that. What do you think about that?
That clarifies the
yes. Maybe in the exposition, you see, I didn't bring out those things as I should have done, but I'm sorry for that. But that's the position as I see it.
Can I come in on another practical issue? So you talk about parents taking time with the children to explain things, but I think we probably all recognize that some of our great responsibilities to spend time with our children. I wondered how some of the slightly older men who are in the ministry with the families deal with this problem, or the problem of the demands that's made on them through the work.
I think there could be a lot of helpful advice about that. In this modern world, when so many wives go out to work or have to go out to work, it's a great problem. I was thinking principally of the mothers, really, Frank, when I said that, and I think perhaps you would agree, because the mother is nearer to the children in many ways, especially in earliest years. And I'm impressed with the mothers and who are most successful in bringing up their children in the Lord, with the time they take from the earliest years with their little ones to be with them and to answer the questions and take time to explain and teach them. I think it's a wonderful thing.
I think that we have to make sure that the minister himself, the father, stays close to the parent, to the children. I think this is something that quite a few older ministers have said, looking back from their lives, that if they could live them again in the younger ministry with their children when they were young, they might have spent more time with their families. I know we tried to, but one little boy who came recently to our house said, when I was taking him home on Saturday night, "Does Richard's dad, is he never out of the study?" So I think this is something we've got to bear in mind.
That yes, I agree.
The minister himself, who is the father, must spend time with the children.
Yes.
I would like to testify to an experience I've had over the years. I learned my lesson very late. I've got three children and they all know the Lord, so I praise the Lord for that. Certainly praise my wife for the great job she did, but it took me an awful long time to learn to make time for my children, and I didn't do to begin with. And I would say to those of you who are early on in your ministry, make time for your children. Make time every day. It's not I every day and every week, but make the time. I missed out in that way. I learned it later on, and I certainly appreciated them. But, I just praise the Lord that they've come on as they have. But it's really an invaluable lesson to learn early on.
So it's evening time, is it, Charlie?
This is evening time,
huh? Evening time.
In fact, Charlie, that was in the back of my mind.
Yes.
In fact, I think a lot of us might feel guilty about taking time, saying this time is for our children. You know, and the phone rings and we think, well, we must answer that, must do something. And we feel guilty about discharging our responsibility to our children. And I think this is an important myth that's got to be abolished.
When I'm thinking of taking time, I see it in Christian homes over against what one sees in public, and that's only a little. You see mothers, particularly with little children, sometimes father and mother, little children in public, in the shops or the buses or wherever, and they're not behaving, the poor little thing, you see, and it can be very difficult, really very obstreperous, and the way they haul them and pull them and shove them as if they were a trolley, and just it's obvious that they're not cared for as they should be, or else they wouldn't behave like that. One of the astonishing things I find about our primary Sunday school from the age of 3, sometimes less than that, to 7, is how very quickly they learn to behave in church, and scarcely a word, because they're trained to behave at home. Thing.
I say a lot. Time is important, but it's not so much time as what you are yourself. That the children know what is important to you.
Yes.
They know. We never had any trouble with our children going to church. They took it as natural. Went from very small, 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
To church and behave in church.
Yeah.
No noise.
They had to.
But they realised, not so much what we said to them, but they realised that this was important to us. And therefore, they followed. It became important. You know, the psychologist says, it's not what you say. I can't hear what you're saying, but what you are.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they knew that this was, although I admit that I've made many, many, many mistakes with my children. And we older people who grandchildren now, we look back and wish we hadn't done certain things and said certain things. And we try to make up for it in our grandchildren. Of course, we can't interfere there. I'm getting a nudge from my husband to sit down. The theologians will probably laugh at this, but I have a very simple, homely idea about election. The predestination. How does God know that one child is going to be a Christian and the other is not? And my idea about this is that there's not such a thing as time with God. That he lives in the paths
in the present and in the future, and he sees it all, and he knows what's going to take place. He knows it all. That may sound, I know the theologians will sound that, but that satisfies me.
Thank you, my dear. Yes, Bertie.
I'd like to come back on the responsibility thing, because I think that, you know, come to adult, children are responsible for the lives that they live, and, you know, whether they choose to come towards God or not. I think of a lady in our village who's a sort of fine Christian lady who's got a daughter who's had two children by separate fathers, and she's married to neither. And the pain it was causing her, you know, because she felt responsible for her daughter going that way. And in my feeling, she's not responsible for a child any longer, because the daughter's an adult. And, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, once you become an adult, then I am responsible for what I do, not the parents. They're not responsible.
Is she a Christian now, mother?
My mother's a fine Christian lady and has been and brought a child up to be a Christian.
It's not too late to believe, rather than pray for me. Ever.
Could I open up just one further area? I think that for those who have manses several miles from their churches, this will never arise. But for those who, like myself, live over the shop, as it were, there's a constant tension between what you give the family and what you give the church, and how open your manse is to the church. Now, I have had a lot of discussion with other ministers in this position. We have an open manse. The man in the next parish is a closed manse. His is kind of Fort Knox. His family and wife are inside, and the rest of them are outside. They don't get in. And we've tried to sort of say, well, all right, we have a Christian family here. We must minister to our children. We must also minister to the people outside. Now, this involves enormous risk, because sometimes we've got all the local yabos coming in, sitting down and just, you know, my wife runs a club for the sort of local nutters on Wednesday night. And they come in and they all sit around and discuss all sorts of weird subjects. And from time to time, my son would say a word that I regard as nasty, and I say to him, "Don't you say that." And he says, "Where did you hear that?" "I heard that in church." And he's hearing it from them. And that's part of the risk, unfortunately. Could anyone else share about this, about how to get this balance between what you give to the family, what you give to the people, how much you let them mix, and how much it costs?
Come on now, there's a challenge. Someone with experience of this.
I don't know whether to say something. I've got no answer. Put your finger on a very important point. I think if we tend to think of the parental responsibility for the upbringing and the faith and the conversion of children in isolation, we are creating and enhancing this tension, because the other side of it is the demand made particularly upon the men, the ministers and the elders, in terms of the time they have to spend at the church and at church meetings, and the tension which this creates between the wife who's left at home and feels the responsibility of the children, and the husband who feels the responsibility for the church and for the public life. It comes to breaking point at times. And I think that balance is one word. I think also a drawing together. One thing we haven't spoken about, and I'd like to hear Mr. Still comment on it, is what is the responsibility of the congregation for the children? Where do the others in the congregation come into the picture? Because we're not families in isolation, parents and children. Families within God's Christian family.
Well, that would vary a very great deal according to the congregation. Some young ministers and wives are into a congregation where there may not be any Christian families at all, or maybe one or two. Our situation now, after so many years, is very, very different. And the Sunday school and primary school teachers for the younger ones, very, very important. We've got some lovely motherly souls that look after the children, and they meet their friends there. And there's a fellowship. But of course, this is part of the setup in our place, that it is a family fellowship, and there's absolutely no segregation of ages and sexes or anything of that kind whatsoever, except at the primary go out for after half an hour and have their little lesson. That's the only separation of any of us at all, and as soon as the service is over, they are running around amongst all the rest of the folk. And I think it's very important that Christian families should get together in this way. I'm sure in our setup there's an awful lot of socialising between the Christian families and their children. That's obvious. You can see that they know one another very well. In, say, the like of Glasgow, in particular, where families are separated by many miles, they can't possibly do that so often. But I think that's very helpful. And the children learn from one another. And they learn from one another's parents, and then there just grows up a certain ethos, and it's not a bit hooded or blind, because all these kids, even from the age of five, have to suffer school. And I know of little ones of 5 and 6 who really have to stand up for the Lord Jesus Christ at school amongst their peers, and will come home weeping at what's said to them, what's done to them, because they are in their own sweet natural way to speak of the Lord. And that's another area that we haven't mentioned, a very, very important one. Many of you will know that you've got to combat so much that, as you were saying, from kids outside and from kids at school and so on. That's great. It's nice of you to share these things. Let's have more of that rather than me speaking, because I've said my bit. Come on, share.
Could I ask what people think of involving children in one's ministry, and whether this takes away any sense of bitterness or resentment that children might feel about father spending so much time in ministry. Our little one's only 2 and a half, but I try to involve him as very much as possible in the ministry, in little ways. When we have our devotional meeting in the manse, he's there giving out the hymn books and shouting out the numbers. He comes across the church as often as possible to open it and get everything ready. And in all these little ways, I like to involve him in my ministry. And I wonder if people could share on how children can be involved in one's ministry and how this helps the man's family.
When I was in Blackpool one year, I was very impressed with a United Reformed church we visited, where we met at the door. We had our family with us, and two girls. And they were met at the door by a husband, a wife, and the two children, who were all giving out the hymn books into the church. And the remarkable thing was that when we went back the second week, they remembered us and welcomed us. And they had this family atmosphere, which, of course, one of the great ideas of the church is the family, the other one is the body. The home is a vehicle of grace is a rather lovely term that I've been encouraged to think of, just as a church is a vehicle of grace. And that has helped me quite a lot in the years, I think.
Of course, missionary families find that it's a tremendous means of evangelism, the Christian home in the midst of a pagan society, although we're a pagan society here.
I was just going to say that it was last night when I was hurrying out to the evening service, I was saying goodnight to my little 4-year-old girl, and I was giving her a little cuddle, and she held me very closely round the neck, and she said to me, "Oh, please, Dad, don't go to church tonight. Can't you read me the story tonight and see me to bed?" I think one of the major problems is that the most lovely time of the day to spend with the children is the very time when so often we are rushing out And I may have a meeting, perhaps at 8, but I'm still thinking out in my mind what I've got to say at the meeting. And I think that's a major problem that I have with my two little ones, 4 years and 2 years. It's a time when I really would like to be with them. You read in books how it's good to spend that time quietly so that their fears and anxieties can surface, and then you can chat about them and pray over them. And yet it's that very time when I find that I'm perhaps most on call, the visits and the meetings which have to be held in the evening round about 7 o'clock onwards.
Yes.
I don't know how others...
Yeah. What others to say about that? Yes, my dear.
It's just in relation to this very point. We've come up against that too, especially with our eldest one, who's now saying to her husband, "Daddy, I think you've got far too many meetings. We always have to rush away." And up until now, we've reckoned that we're terribly unfortunate in that we have a family who rise terribly early. Our eldest is up every morning at 5:30. And he doesn't go to bed, well, he goes to bed early as well, I suppose, but it doesn't matter when he goes to bed, he's still up early. And having read a non-Christian article in a non-Christian magazine about parents who faced this problem, who had unsocial working hours, and how they overcame the problems of fathers not seeing their children, we are now coming round to the idea that although David would love to spend that time at night with the boys and Sarah as well, it is just not possible, and the children have to understand this. But to try to make up for it by us, as far as we are able, making the best use of what obviously God has given them, an early rising hour. And perhaps if we, perhaps if we discipline ourselves so that we are able to spend even an hour and a half with them before breakfast, an hour even before breakfast, then perhaps to some extent we are going to give them something that we can't do for them in the evening. I think this is something that we are gradually coming to see.
That shakes you.
Is it possible to open a window?
Oh,
no.
Yes.
Is it possible to open a window?
Oh. Open a window.
Would you open that window just at your back?
It's open.
Pull the card. That's a very challenging point. Go on, somebody else on that line.
Understand it. A ministry wife is a very important person, and she understands her husband. Well, as someone was saying, the minister is going out of seven. We work at that, they're going out and I'm coming in. So therefore, a wife at that point, it's her job then perhaps to take over, not take over, but evening is the time when all the children seem to ask questions just when they're being put to bed.
Yes.
And we had a panel the other night at our young mothers group. One of the ladies was just saying it is definitely the time that we cannot rush putting children off to bed. So often we're tired because we've perhaps been out all day and we're glad to see them popping into bed and to be able to do the things we want to do. But just as you're slipping downstairs and the door is left open, you think, ah, that's them safely off. You hear the little voice saying, "Mummy." And so you have to go running up, and you just cannot run away because we have so many questions to ask. And as was said, it's true that evening is the time we can't always spend because the fathers are going out. But if his wife, if Mrs. wife is understanding and knows he's got to go, and it's her job then to take special care at that time, to spend time with the children, I'm sure the Lord doesn't make us suffer for the minister having to be out, because if we work together as husband and wife with our children that way, then there are other compensations. The father perhaps can be able to spend time other times. If he's got meetings at night, well, maybe another time perhaps he can work out. But the difficulty is for him to work out the time that he feels not guilty at taking off, as we said before.
Yes. You see the difficulty about the evening. That was the time that you spent once you got round to it with your children.
Any time.
Available. Well, I agree with what you're saying, Barbara, that the mother, in many cases, Fergus, would you agree, has to take over. She's to be... because
well, there's very often no option at that time, but it grieves me, and I do feel guilty about it. because I know that, well, the four-year-old one anyway, desires so much to see her father at that time and just share with him. It's not that my wife can't do it any better, but she just wants me.
Yes, and a week while you'll be taking her to church. Sir?
Still, I think we're being a little bit overprotective. I think that the father's job is in the world and the mother's job is in the home. I agree with my sister here so much. And I know what it is to enjoy the fellowship of children like Fergus here, but I think we must deny ourselves this. And my sacred memories of childhood are my mother teaching me to pray, reading me Bible stories and making theological points from them that still last with me today. And I said to Professor Meadow Ewan MacDonald when I met Trinity College, I said, Professor, I've learned a lot here, but what I learned at my mother's knee means more to me than anything I learned. And then I said to him, and I'm sure you will agree with me, that there was so in your case. And he nodded, whether it was out of good manners. I think the man's job is in the field, on the sea, in the church, and at the front of the battle. And surely the child would admire the father when he grows up a bit, to know that he was speaking in presbytery or preaching the gospel in his circumstances. And this is what the kid looks to, I think, from the father. In my own case, I lost my wife when my twins were born, and I had many things against me. But I held on to what a Free Church minister said to me when he baptized my twins. He said, the vows of God are upon you. And I remembered that.
Yes.
And God did wonderfully bless me. They're both Christians today. And he gave me a wonderful second partner who is with me today and has done a tremendous job for me. And God has overruled everything for good. And I'm just delighted to realize that infant baptism is a wonderful thing when we remember that God is there at work and he sees our faith with all its deficiencies. And in his mercy, he blesses us.
Thank you.
But you know, the logical outcome of that is that fathers shouldn't have children.
Just mother.
I think that's ridiculous. The other thing I would say is this, in Scripture, there's far more about fathers with their children than mothers with their children.
Yes.
Mr. Still, I'm married, but I don't have any children as yet. But all of a sudden, I'm not looking forward. Perhaps I'm being very simplistic about my thoughts. I'll assume they're going to my own parish. But I'm dying to know about all these meetings that take place between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock. You know, that they hinder parents spending a short time with their children or spending an hour.
Is it mostly visits to organisations and things that you're thinking about those hours? I mean, an office bearers meeting wouldn't be until 7:30, would it not? 7?
It's the going to bed time that's at 7.
It's
late
7:30.
Yeah. Jim, you're hard on Brother George. You're hard because he put it extremely, perhaps more extremely than he... Well, you have to do that to make a point. The Lord does that, you know. But... There is something there. Through history, you read the history of the divines of earlier days, and it's the same complaint all the time. I think it simply must be. I agree very much with him. Not 100%, but I see your point too.
I'm thinking about Mr. Still, is that I remember, when was it when Mr. Alexander spoke to us about the minister's time? I remember he spoke very forcibly, and I've heard him a number of times on this subject, about guarding your mornings. You must spend your mornings in your study. Perhaps we've got to learn that we've just got to guard half an hour or an hour or so on every day for our children. We've not only to guard our mornings, we've got to guard our children as well. And perhaps that's a lesson we've got to learn.
Well, half an hour is not very long, and yet it can be a long time if it's wisely used. Eh? Couldn't it be? Now, who's first? Come on. You had a shot already. This is your last shot.
Yeah, I'd like to hear Mary's comments about that.
Yes,
I mean,
but
you
just
know more about the effect of the lack of the father's participation.
We'll just leave Mary for a little while.
I'm not allowed to speak here. It's the reality. That's what it's all about.
Eh? Oh, you are. Now, would you like to... Hold on. Come away.
No, it's just on the point of the... I feel that when we stand and take vows in baptism, it's not just the mother who stands and takes them herself, the father is there as well. And I think when we are performing baptism for other people, we expect a lot from them as parents. And yet we use our own job as an excuse not to be what we should be. And I think one of the problems that you have with your children, we have already had with our son, he feels he always brings his model kit out when my husband's going out, and I'm not good at models. And I think what very often happens is that ministers have set evenings they must be out. They've got to be at the evening service, they've got to be at the session meeting, the Bible study, and the prayer meeting. But there are other two or three other nights which very often the husband looks up and says, oh, I've got this free night, I'll be able to do such and such. And I think that is one area where they could really look very seriously at spending with their wives too, and not only with their children.
Yes, that's right.
Couldn't we bear in mind that, first of all, we're not ministers and our wives, we're parents. And we've been given children, and part of this is the stewardship of time. Now, what about the Christian welder and the Christian fabricator who works shifts? And probably his wife works shifts. So as one walks out of day shift, the other walks into back shift, or take hospital situations. Mm-hmm. Now, we've come through this in pre-study days, where I was nursing, my husband was shift working, and we had four children. And we had 4 and 5 years. Now, I'm not being an oracle, but we maintained the love that God gave us. We maintained the stewardship of time. Sometimes it meant Douglas was with the children at times of worship, or I was with them. Now, our children are grown up now. Some of them have professed faith in the Lord. But at the same time, we still have family gatherings of one time or another. Now, I still work shifts. I'm still not always there. But have a very loving home and a very loving God who still teaches us that stewardship isn't just giving of our money, it's giving of our time and our whole lives to the Lord. So let's think of ourselves as Christian people, not just ministers and their wives.
Now, there are lots of other hands. Where are they? Bob.
The one thing I would say to my brother here is that once you get into the ministry, you find that it would be lovely to think that you could be on a 9-to-5 job. It would be lovely to think that you could keep all your mornings free. Being something like now 22 years in the ministry, I've never found it that way, and I don't find it any easier as the years go on. We've been blessed with 3 children. We've come through a period of time when indeed you can put them to bed, and you know they're there. They then come to the teenage years. You see the cough scene beginning to affect one. You look at the youngest, who is so interested in horses that you say she will never think of the cough scene. But if she comes to a certain age in life, the cough scene begins to affect her. Yes. And therefore, we've gone through a time like that with our children. I've never forced them in any way. They've been prayed for. They've been brought up in the faith. As the information was given to others within our own congregation that there would be the membership class, so it was given to my own family. In no way at all, as it were, did I say to them, it's time you're joining the church, it's time you were a Christian, and so on. And therefore, my oldest daughter, my only son, They both came, as it were, their own way. And in no way at all could they say that their father, as it were, sort of said to them, you know, it's time that you are becoming a member of the church. They came their own particular way. What I would say, and I think you'll stand with me in this, that it's one thing while they are young and when you can put them to bed and so on. But when they come up, when they come into their teenage years, the impact of the world comes upon them, whether we like it or not. The impact of the school that they go to, whether we like it or not. And these are factors indeed that have their impact upon our children. And I think too that what we must remember is that whether we like it or not, we are looked upon as the man's family. No longer do my family sit in a man's pew. They sit other places in the church. Because I know indeed that there's always that certain people look in the man's family, and the man's family have got to sit up, as it were, you know, just so perfect in every particular way. And therefore my family are free to sit where they want to sit, you know, within the church. But I'm aware of the pressures on my family in school. Where in a sense, your dad's the minister. How can you not answer this biblical question or this religious question? I don't think I'm giving any secrets away. Our present moderator, Andrew Doe, I remember Barbara telling me I was in that presbytery at that time. Their daughter went to Dalkeith Academy and came under such pressure because she was the minister's daughter that was one of the reasons why they had to move her into an Edinburgh school. And I know just recently, around Christmas time, I was taking a stand in Falkirk against the opening of shops on the Lord's Day. It was printed very much in full, and I was interviewed about it, and indeed was told that other ministers' opinions were being sought to discover that mine was the only one that was displayed in the paper. Where did the backlash come? The backlash came in my son, who works as an apprentice joiner. He was cussed. He was asked, in a sense, what right had his father, as it were, to say whether the shop should be open or not. And these are the kind of tensions that I have known within my home and within my family. And the one thing after all these years is perhaps indeed that Janice, when she was a very little girl, said, and it's come through in conversation today, my daddy's full of wee meetings. Now sometimes these meetings are necessary. And if I look back and perhaps I say to myself before God, I am sorry that perhaps there were times when I didn't spend more time with my children. But I think one thing we must remember as ministers is this. There are times when we are in our home, when other men are out at work. There are times when your children are 2, 3 and 4, when you're in the study. And if you're so busy in the study that you can't break for a quarter an hour for a cup in the morning and play with your child, or see in a sense that watching with mother is on, and I can remember my daughter when watching with mother, the tears began to flow, 1:30, 1:45 before you go out in the afternoon, then I would say there is something wrong. So that there is time given to us if we look out for that time and we can use it with our children. And indeed, I trust that we'll find this as we go on. And to come back to Phil's point, when we came into the ministry, we knew what we were coming into. And did Jesus not say something about loving father and mother and children and homes and brothers and sisters more than him? And therefore there can be times when no matter how much dearly indeed we would like to be there, the call can come. Because some soul is in desperate need.
Mr. Stone, can I make a point about this thing about time? Before we get married, a parish minister made the point to me, which I think is very valid. He said that it's quite probable that in your life you'll make 3 sets of vows. You're a minister of a charge and you'll make vows of ordination. Getting married, you're making vows of marriage. And if you have children, you're making baptismal vows. Now he said, as far as he could understand scripture, there was no ranking of these vows, that they were all vows before God, that each had to be honoured and time had to be made for your work and for your wife and for your children. I think that's a very valid thing, that It's not a question of anything being squeezed in or squeezed out, but before God, you've made solemn promises in all these areas.
Yes.
Can I make 2 points, please? First of all, that I think we do tend to have a feeling that being in the ministry is somehow unique, and of course, in a sense, it is. But that there are many other occupations which involve working of difficult hours. And, I mean, we all know people who work on oil rigs, or who maybe have to fly to Saudi Arabia for their job, and this kind of thing, or people in the army, who are away from their home for long periods of time. And I think it's important that we shouldn't always be trying to compare ourselves, as some ministers and their wives do, to people they know who work 9-to-5 jobs, clerical jobs, and that kind of thing. When you're in a responsible job, or a job which involves travel away from home, then many of the same pressures are found in other families as in our families. And the second thing is that it seems to me the key, surely, to a family life which hangs together and which doesn't give rise to disagreement and to rankling, is one which has been discussed and planned. And that the need really is for people to work out their priorities and to work out how they're going to spend their time and how they're going to make the most of the particular advantages of a sort of ministerial lifestyle, with its long vacations and with its flexibility and so on and so forth, and fitting this in and working out how time will be spent. And the problems surely arise when these things haven't been thought out, and when we're at the mercy of every circumstance, and we aren't ourselves having the initiative in the way in which we order our lives.
Yes, I'm sure that's it's very much a matter of discipline, but it has to be a discipline in the context of great adaptability and improvisation, because calls come at all time, and what you plan for a day may be rudely interrupted a number of times, and one has to have a very clear sense of priorities about things. The needs of the people can be very, very clamant and very urgent, but the needs of one's children too. But you see, there are two parents, and I think this simply needs to be balanced. There's times when the mummy has to be daddy too, and there are many lovely children being brought up with one parent, and are a credit to them. Yes, Rex. Just a moment.
I give up.
You're out of sight.
You're George down next.
Come on next. You're out of sight, Rex.
One of the things we haven't mentioned, the pressures on family, and I'm speaking of one who's council ministry late in life, and therefore one is now talking to young families and young engaged people. One of the things that I have found talking to married families is the fact that they never discussed how they were going to discipline their children before they were married. More and more I discovered that this has come to them with a bang after they were married, because they've not prayed about this during their years of engagement and discussed it fully. And perhaps I'm a bit of a rebel, but when I talk to young engaged couples, I remind them that when they take their married vows, before God they're going to become a complete unit under Him. There are three people in that family the moment they cross the threshold of their home. Three people in their home. God and husband and wife, or the devil and husband and wife. And that nobody, despite the eternal triangle is there right from where it goes. Some of them don't like it, because I go on to say that they must be united right from the word go in what they say and do. And they need to realize that in-laws can be their worst enemy. I was privileged to be brought up in a Christian home. My father was a medical missionary, and as a child of a missionary family, the fact that we have to forego our parental love, so far as England's parents, because one was away at school and they were on the mission field. These are things which are accepted. Yeah. They may not be approved by the church, but they are eventually accepted. The other thing is the fact that so often we leave our wives to bring up our children. There's a tremendous danger in the wife having all the discipline, because a child commits an error and you expect that error to be dealt with by your wife. Now, I find no evidence that a father is excluded. In fact, when one looks at it, you have God as the head of the home. You have two laborers, but the husband is the chief laborer. And to my mind, it is the husband who is underlined in the Bible as being disciplinarian. And too many of us fathers leave that discipline to our wives because it's easier. It's hard to come back and deal with discipline in cold blood. And as a result, children fail one against the other. And they may be little saints, but they can sometimes be little devils. And if they can get away and cause that division and get mother and father to argue in front of them,
yeah,
they pick up the weak thing.
Absolutely deadly.
Then they come, and the family is divided. And as I tell the young people to sort out this problem before you get married, and make certain that none of your in-laws cross your door, your threshold, without both of you jointly agreeing. I had one couple who came and asked me to marry them in church, and I said this about their parents, and within 24 hours I had the parents round to see me. And I told them the same thing, and they all left the church. But nevertheless, I believe that each family unit is created by God. There's a new unit in Him, and nobody must split that unit or interfere, except under the law.
Thank you, ladies. Now, George, you were out of the line.
It's been so long, I've almost forgotten. We got the impression that there was only one half of a meeting.
But I'm sorry, George. I'm sure you would make your presence felt in the presbytery.
We're on debate. One of the things we are tending to forget is that the good Almighty God knows about all these terribly deprived children who have the misfortune of having a minister as their father. And if we believe in the grace of God, we must believe in the providing grace of God. And I'm quite sure that as the children grow up, Robert McGee spoke about the happy time when, well, 6:30, 7 o'clock, you knew your kids were safely tucked up in bed. I have reached the stage now that you look at the clock and it's 12:30 and you wonder when they're going to come home. You're quite sure that they're all right. You're not doubting them, but you're human and you wonder. But God knows. It was God who put us into the ministry.
Yes.
It's God who gives life and gave us our children. My experience is that the kids grow up